that we use as herbicide probably causes cancer. And that's sprayed throughout everywhere, and it's sprayed heavily on our food. And so that's something that we beekeepers will probably be moving towards, asking the city to ban the Roundup on our playground fields. We don't need to be playing in that. And the Roundup has been associated with the monarch die-off. Right now, the eastern monarch is considered critically threatened, like it may be extinct soon. And that's been following the huge spraying of Roundup on Roundup-resistant GMO crops. So buy organic foods when possible, and tell your neighbors not to use that Roundup. It's much more deadly than we thought.
Okay. Thank you for coming down.
Sure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. All right. And don't forget to go to the movie tomorrow. Occupy the Farm at 6:30 p.m. On April 2nd at Clinton Street Theater. That's co-sponsored by KBOO, and it's very inspiring.
Right on.
Mike, Jen, thank you very much for joining us today. We will be joined by you, hopefully again, next week. And until then, everyone have a great week.
Thank you.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. Susan Griffin is an internationally celebrated writer who will speak on the false divisions our culture makes between body and soul, masculine and feminine, self and other, that allow us to hide from our own knowledge. Again, that's Susan Griffin, Sustainability in the Soul, Thursday, April 9th, 7 p.m. in the Sanctuary. 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We're at the Erez Crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Sponsored by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. On Thursday, April 9th, 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Center, room 338. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week we have a special new program, new to us anyway, from WPFW, Askia Muhammad produced in 1980 an interview with Ethel L. Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. And now we have a documentary to present to you that was produced by Askia Muhammad himself just this year. So without further ado, let's get started with Ethel L. Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.
The Black Scholars Radio Series and WPFW-FM present Ethel L. Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.
An emotional high from many standpoints. America was put on trial. It was really a moment of truth, and it was a test of the resiliency of black people in this country. And I think, well, it drew worldwide attention, as you well know. It was just one of those great moments in history. It's much like, if I would make a comparison, I would say it was like when Mahatma Gandhi in India led his movement, or even the Long March by Mao Zedong in China. The Montgomery bus protest, the Montgomery protest movement, can be compared with those great events in history.
Let them speak who have seen with their eyes.
On March 16, 1827, Freedom's Journal, the first black newspaper, was born in the United States, proclaiming these words: "We wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us." On August 14, 1911, Ethel Lois Payne was born in the Bronzeville neighborhood of the South Side of Chicago. She joined her ancestors on May 28, 1991. In August 2002, the United States Postal Service issued a 37-cent postage stamp commemorating the woman who had come to be known as the First Lady of the Black Press. In February 2015, Amistad Books published Eye on the Struggle by James McGrath Morris, celebrating the largely unsung achievements of this pioneering black journalist who broke down the barriers of race and gender in the White House press corps and in news capitals around the world. In the spring of 1980, I interviewed my friend for a radio series saluting older black intellectuals. I'm Askia Muhammad, and this is a look into the life of Ethel L. Payne with James McGrath Morris, and in her own words. Her credo was a simple one. I go back to Frederick Douglass's words: agitate, agitate.
What's the most interesting story that you've covered here or abroad?
Well, the civil rights movement, of course, was a high point. Nobody who was involved in that could not really feel emotionally deeply involved also personally in the civil rights movement, particularly of the 60s. Actually, it began in 1955, was it 1955?
December 1st,
the Montgomery movement. And to me, that was really one of the finest hours in this country. And I really believe that because it had such a tremendous impact, and it really was the whole thrust of the civil rights movement. I don't think we'll ever have a finer demonstration of unity and of real spiritual movement than you would compare with the Montgomery bus protest.
Well, let's take a break for just a moment. This is Brian from the Vault again. Since we're on the subject of the Montgomery bus boycott, we'd like to take a moment to contextualize it with one of the Pacifica Radio Archives' treasures, the first interview with Rosa Parks after her arrest in 1955. This interview was conducted in 1956. After this, we will return to WPFW's profile of Ethel L. Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.
Yes, I have been refused entrance on the buses because I would not pay my fare at the front and go around to the rear door to enter.
Let me have that again now. You mean you pay your fare at the front and then we're forced to walk around and enter into the rear door?
Yes, that was the custom if the bus was crowded up to the point where the white passengers would start occupying.
And even if it was raining or anything of that sort, you might have to pay your fare at the front and walk back in the rain to the back of the bus and get in.
Yes, that's true.
Well, Mrs. Parks, then you were arrested, and you say you went to, you posted bond. Did you have a trial?
Yes.
And you were found innocent or guilty?
Guilty.
You were found guilty, and then what?
The case was appealed.
How did this particular incident of your being arrested and convicted and appealing, how did this lead to this particular protest?
From the time of the arrest on Thursday night and Friday and Saturday and Sunday, the word had gotten around over Montgomery of my arrest because of this incident. And people just began to decide that they wouldn't ride the bus on the day of my trial, which was Monday, December 5th. And Monday morning, when the buses were out on their regular run, they remained empty, and people were walking or getting rides in cars with people who would pick them up as best they could. On Monday night, the mass meeting at the Holt Street Baptist Church had been called, and there were many thousands of people there. They kept coming, and some people never did get in the church. There were so many. And the first day of remaining off the bus had been so successful, it was organized then that we wouldn't ride the bus until our request had been granted.
Well, Mrs. Parks, how did word get around Montgomery, Alabama, so quickly? First of all, that you were arrested and convicted, and second of all, how did the word get around so quickly that there would be a meeting and that people would refuse to ride?
There were telephone calls from those who knew about it to others, and also an article came out in the newspaper on Friday morning about the Negro woman overlooked segregation. She was seated in the front seat, the white section of the bus, and refused to take a seat in the rear of the bus. That was a first newspaper account.
They didn't ride on the day of the trial. They walked. And then how come they kept right on walking?
I feel they kept on walking because I was not the only person who had been mistreated and humiliated. Others had gone through the same experience, some even worse experience than mine, and they all felt that the time had come that they should decide that we would have to stop supporting the bus company until we were given better service.
How did it happen to become the kind of religious movement it became? Or at least we seem to understand it as a kind of a religious movement. There is the talking of walking and praying. There is the whole appeal to the religious, peaceful aspect. And of course, a number of ministers have taken a very active part in the leadership. How did this come about?
I think this came about because the ministers were very much interested in it, and we had our meetings in the churches. And being the minority, we felt that nothing could be gained by violence or threats or a belligerent attitude. We believed that more could be accomplished through the nonviolent passive resistance. We had no quarrel with anyone. We only want to stop riding the buses until we are treated as any other passenger.
The first interview with Rosa Parks after her arrest in 1955. This interview was conducted in 1956. And now we will return to WPFW's profile of Ethel L. Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.
Who was the most interesting person that you've ever met?
By far, Lyndon Johnson. He was a massive character on the pages of history. He made big mistakes as well as big improvements.
Real Texan.
Yes. Even more than that, he was just a monumental figure. It was his great, great forte was in domestic affairs. He just got skewered when he really got into the thick of foreign policy. He was not really, attuned to it. So when he made the mistake of escalating the war in Vietnam, that became the albatross around his neck.
What's the most interesting place you've been?
Well, the most interesting place that I would say in all my travels was my visit to the People's Republic of China. Largely because it was such unexplored territory. And then I went in with a group of journalists in 73. So China was still a giant awakening at that time, and still very much a closed society, and really sort of apprehensive about letting foreigners in.
I'd like to ask you now to say just a few words about a number of people who come to my mind who your career has touched First, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Martin Luther King Jr. He was an idea whose time had really come. I cannot recall early in 1956 when the Montgomery movement was beginning to reach its peak. And Time magazine did an article. In fact, he was the Times Man of the Year cover. And in the article, I'll never forget the phrase that was used. He struck where it was least expected, at the white Christian conscience of the South. And that was very true. That was very true. It was totally unexpected, this kind of a thrust. And it was very disturbing. But at the same time, it shook the foundations of this country. And it aroused both hate and penitence, in a way of speaking. And certainly, it changed the whole face of the country as far as civil rights were concerned.
John F. Kennedy.
Probably the most aristocratic president we've had in the White House. A man who was young and brilliant and surrounded himself with brilliant people. Just didn't live long enough to carry out his mission.
Thurgood Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall, one of my favorite people. I knew him from years back. I would say he was a rugged individualist in many ways. Certainly, he deserves a great place in history for his leadership in the legal battle for civil rights. A very homey character, and one who just had the ability to adapt to people anywhere, and who I think is really a great person.
Richard Nixon.
Oh, probably will go down in history as the man who did more than anything else contributed to the abuse of the powers of the presidency. In his wake, too many evils occurred. I think it really ruptured the moral fabric of this country, his conduct in office.
Louis Martin.
Probably one of the cleverest maneuverers who's ever been in politics, barring none, white or black. In his heyday, he was probably the only black that I knew of, unless you would consider somebody like Raymond Jones, who was limited to New York politics. But Louis Martin, in his heyday, was about as wily and influential as any black has ever been in politics.
I was looking for another journalist to write about. I'd written about Pulitzer, I'd written about Charles Chapin, I wrote a book about prison journalism. The inmates produced newspapers. And Ethel Payne kept showing up on lists of American journalists, and it intrigued me because I like to write a story that others haven't written. You know, I don't want to write yet another biography of Ronald Reagan, for instance. And I was convinced when I started exploring her story that somebody was already at work on it. I mean, it's just, you know, you're a reporter and journalist. You know, when you come across a good story, say, somebody else is doing it. And when I discovered that in two cases her papers had never been processed, meaning no one had ever opened up the boxes, I thought to myself, no one is working on this. And it combined my love of journalism. I thought she was an incredibly significant figure and long overdue. She is one of the more significant journalists of the 20th century that paid attention to the civil rights movement and was a critical link between readers and the movement. But the reason I wrote the book in part is that this the segregation of the past remains in our historical view. She was an iconic figure to older people, and every day when I do an event, somebody comes up to me and says, I knew Ethel Payne, I read Ethel Payne. But to a large percentage of Americans, she's unknown. And that's because when the black press was flowering and really an important part of our society, it was completely invisible to white Americans. I mean, they didn't even know of its existence, not to mention, you know, not read it. And so, in some ways, the book is an attempt to try to restore a place in the pages of history for her. I think the most interesting thing for me was not that she made civil rights her beat. She decided when she came to Washington and then when she went to South and Montgomery and other places that that this was a story for her. What I thought was really interesting, two things I think are interesting about it. One is her connection between the black freedom struggle in the United States and the freedom struggle around the world, and her ability to find a way to go to Africa 13 times, to go to Indonesia, to go to Asia, to try to write a connection between the larger international freedom struggle and the freedom struggle here. The second thing I thought, this surprised me, because you know when you start on a project, you really don't know. She had an extraordinarily keen journalist's eye. And I think the telling moment is when she goes to Montgomery when the bus boycott begins. And this is a moment when people like Martin Luther King and Abernathy's names, if they appeared in the white press, appeared in sort of like these odd names, like M period L period King is how he was referred to. And she was there very early, and she was the first to notice how the change in the leadership were going to men of the cloth, which of course is profound. And yet, I don't think of her as, in a sense, having a historical sense. She'd worked with A. Philip Randolph, but she, I don't know if she could compartmentalize the civil rights movement at looking at Randolph and then legal folks like Thurgood Marshall, but she saw right then and there that this new gladiator going into battle wears a reverse collar and holds a Bible in his hand, and she talked about that. And that perception, had it been made in the mainstream press, would be quoted every day today. But because of who she was writing for, the people who now make decisions about history don't see how incredibly clairvoyant she was at that moment. There have been readers, for instance, assembled of civil rights history, and if you look, of civil rights journalism, if you look, she's not included. And I think the reason is not as much hostility, but a misunderstanding. These historians look at her copy, and it seems to them sometimes simplistic, but they're missing the point. She's writing in a folksy fashion, much like Ernie Pyle did in World War II, almost a letter home. And if you look at some of the articles, Ethel Payne sees hate. Payne sends exclusive reports back. It's a personal form of journalism that allowed her to connect with her readers, for whom, because of the barriers in American education, weren't always the most literate of readers. And she reached them, and what the role that she played that I thought was so important was that she informed her readers, but at the same time activated them. And that's why I think her role in civil rights has been underappreciated, that she was this an enormous agent of change, and we don't often think of journalists that way.
Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. I'm Huskia Muhammad. James McGrath Morris is the author of Pulitzer and of The Rose Man of Sing Sing, which was named a Washington Post Book World Best Book of the Year. His book, Eye on the Struggle, brings into focus the riveting life of one of the most significant yet least known figures of the civil rights era, pioneering journalist Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press, elevating her at last to her rightful place in history.
In journalism, there's something you can do when you have money. And the Defender was doing pretty well then. Later, of course, when they're not, it's a very different situation. But yeah, they were extraordinary in that respect. And they were also extraordinary in letting Ethel Payne do more than church news. Church news was very significantly important. I don't mean in a way to diminish it, but there was a kind of sexism about what women could write and couldn't write. And Ethel Payne had extraordinary nerve. When she was young, she wrote W.E. Du Bois and wrote him a letter and said, I'd like to write your biography. Now, keep in mind, this untrained young woman writing to him. And she says, I know it takes skill and research and a number of things and nerve. I don't know about the other things, but I've certainly got nerve. And that's when I realized what a courageous person she was, because she never let anything stop her. And when she worked for A. Philip Randolph during the first March on Washington, you know, he was having women type things. He wasn't going to put them in leadership positions. And she stood up to him. She even called him on the phone and said, if this is the job you're going to give me in Chicago, I don't want it. And that's what she had to do all along. And that's what she had to do with Eisenhower. That's what she had to do when she had to persuade the Chicago Defender to let her go to the South. And that's what she did when a period when you knew her, for instance, when she walked up to the South African embassy with a cane. And the South Africans made a big mistake thinking, what could this woman cause for us problems? And they let her inside. She said, I'm not leaving until you change your ways. I mean, obviously she had a specific demand, but they had to call the police. And she held on to the plastic handcuffs for years after that as I call them jewelry of honor. And when you look at, for instance, Ethel Payne's reaction to the 63 March, first thing she notices is a lack of women who are speaking. I mean, they made reference to. And so that was always a continuing problem, I think, with civil rights leadership, was the friction they caused by not recognizing. And famously, when A. Philip Randolph gives a press conference at the National Press Club in 63, a number of women write and say, you know, we can't come. And he almost doesn't get it. I don't mean to diminish him, but the gender equality was so separated ever since the suffragettes and the abolitionists separated that it affected somebody like Ethel Payne's life, or Dorothy Hyde's life, or Alice Dunningham, or any of the women who worked in the press corps.
Author, poet M. Carl Holman, who founded the National Urban Coalition, said at a testimonial in 1980, quote, I don't know of any race in this earth that can look back to a chain with stronger links than Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, Ida B. Wells, Mary McLeod Bethune, Rosa Parks, Dorothy Height, Shirley Chisholm, Alice Dunnigan, and Ethel Payne.
The Defender, like any publication, focused on issues that they thought interested their readers. And Payne believed that the McCarthy hearings were, Joe McCarthy, you know, we both couldn't remember his name, that the McCarthy hearings weren't of central importance to her readers. And as she says at one point, you know, my community didn't really fear communists. What she had seen as communists is the one folks who showed up when you were being evicted in Chicago, put the furniture back in the apartment and stood guard. And she couldn't understand what all this fuss was, and she didn't think her readers were interested. Well, Annie Moss was called up, an African-American woman who worked in a clerk kind of position, it's been a year or few since I wrote, but I think in the MAP division. And McCarthy was convinced that this was going to be a great witness to interrogate, because she was the one who was passing on secrets. And he was both at the height of his power, but also people were beginning to question what was going on. So they called her up for a hearing, and she was really clueless. And I don't mean to diminish her, but she just didn't understand what was going on. And the more they probed, the more they realized their investigators had done a bad job, because the person that they tied her to turned out not to be the same race as they thought. So that showed this is not the right person. And then they asked a question about Karl Marx, and she said, who? And of course the place burst into laughter. And as you know, humor can destroy people. I mean, think of Dan Quayle and Potato, or Sarah Palin and Saturday Night. And Ethel Payne was there to cover that. I found film footage, and you can see the press table, and she's the only African-American in the room, and she's covering that issue. And she really stood up for Annie Lee Moss, that was her name. Also, people forget that the various communist newspapers were not living off their subscriptions. It was quite the opposite. They were raising money and giving people subscriptions. So you could well end up being... But you know, the parallel to that, of course, that some audiences, because we so forget history, have forgotten, but getting a copy of The Defender in the South was a really dangerous thing. And in fact, in some communities, it was banned by law. And when I've said that to audiences, people say, banned by law? That's amazing. I say, forget about the law. Think about the fact that if you got it by mail, the mailman would report you to people who would take non-legal measures to, you know, suppress you reading that paper. And what I loved was discovering how the Pullman porters used to bring The Defender south on the train and put it in barbershops where you could sneak it home in 6 or 7. And the great link to that is, of course, Ethel Payne's dad had been a Pullman porter. So there are moments in her life that, you know, I wish she were alive to read the book, only because those kinds of connections are so amazing to me.
She stood up to Eisenhower as well.
Yeah, that was a big deal, and it was a big deal in a number of ways. The first incident, I really enjoy being a native Washingtonian because it's a real local story. In 1954, the Republicans were having their Lincoln Day festivities at the Uline Arena, the old arena, and they invited three choirs to come in, two of them from Southern white colleges, and the third choir is Howard University's choir. And the bus is denied entry into the building. Every time they turn, they say, no, go that way, go to the back door, proverbially. So they turn around and go home. So Ethel Payne hears this story. Now, it's not covered by the Washington Post, which prides itself in covering local news. And she goes to the old executive office building to confront Eisenhower at a press conference. She jumps up, Mr. President, Mr. President, gets his attention. She says, the Howard Choir was turned away from your celebration, you know. And he, to his credit, he says, if it was because of race, I apologize. But, you know, I'm president. I don't know who mans what door and all of that. But what she discovered at that moment is that by asking that question, the next day, the Washington Post had a story about the Howard Choir being banned. So did some other papers. And so she came to understand that asking questions of the president at a national press conference could put an issue on the national agenda. So she, like Alice Dunningham, kept bugging the president, asking specific civil rights questions that Clarence Mitchell at the NAACP helped formulate. So the question, you know, really try to nail him. Well, she asked him one day, she said, you know, the Congress could pass a bill under the Constitution using the Commerce Clause to desegregate interstate travel. Would you support that? Eisenhower stood up in his military posture, and he says to her, I don't know where you get off asking that question. And he, the you I'm giving you comes from having driven to Abilene, Kansas to hear the tape. He's really furious. And he says, you know, we're not going to cater to any special group in this administration. And it was clear to the room that what Eisenhower was saying at that point, that the quest for equality by a large segment of American population was like a special interest, no different than the foreign lobby. He realized he'd made a mistake in answering that question. The room realized. The next day, headlines across the country about what it, and that was the last time he decided to call on Ethel Payne for a long, long time. And it also worked for her because the Montgomery bus boycott had gotten underway, so she left town to go and cover that and cover other issues. So it, for her as a journalist, it wasn't the end of her career. But, you know, when the president decides to cease calling on you, that can make life tough. National press conferences, particularly back then, were a very different beast, and Eisenhower held them all the time. One, it was 100% white, and I'm not suggesting that the reporters were purposefully racist, but the issues of segregation didn't enter their mind. They had the privilege of remaining in a homogeneous white society with no barriers. But for Ethel Payne to get up in the morning, or for Alice Dunningham to get up in the morning, just get to the White House and get a cab, or what restaurants, you know, it was never far from their mind. And so when they came to the room, they were going to ask questions not just for the readership, but for themselves. And this was a problem for Ethel Payne, and she used the word problem because she realized she was part of the story, and reporters tend to not want to be part of the story. So instead of being objective, she decided to adopt a notion of fairness. And what's really extraordinary, because she did what I could never do, she wrote about men, particularly men, who would have no interest in giving her equality, who senators who would not talk to her. And she wrote about them in a way that is just, you're struck by her fairness so many years later. It's not like Fox or any of the vitriolic stuff you hear now. Of course, she was clever. She let them hang by their own words. And she also kept the fire at the feet. You know, people forget, because we now think of the Democrats as the forward-thinking party. But in 1957, when the Civil Rights Bill came up, the people who were gutting it were people like Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy. And she'd go up to them right after they got off the floor and say, what do you mean removing that provision about trial by jury on these issues, or putting in the hands of judges or things like that? And what I love is the twists and turns of history. The man, in some sense, who was her hero of the day back then was Vice President Richard Nixon, who, of course, now we think about it, Watergate and Vietnam and his law and order campaign, which was really a subterfuge for against African Americans. But in the 1950s, in 1957, Republicans thought that African Americans could be lured back to their party. And so Richard Nixon was, in many ways, a proponent for civil rights measures that LBJ and John F. Kennedy, who later become famous for having supported them, weren't going to support them at that time.
This is From the Vault, presented by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For more information or to order a copy of this program, call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to our program.
You're listening to Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. I'm Askia Muhammad. Among Ethel Payne's contemporaries who told the tortured story of what civil rights was all about, representing the black press in the otherwise lily-white world of the Washington Press Corps at the height of the civil rights struggle, were Harry McAlpin, the first black reporter to attend the presidential press conference, Simeon Booker, the legendary Johnson Publishing Company Washington bureau chief, and Alice Dunnigan, the first black woman accredited to membership in the White House Press Corps. Biographer James McGrath Morris balanced the roles of both Miss Payne and other journalists in the black press, and in particular, at the Chicago Defender.
She went to Ghana in 1957 to cover the independence of Ghana, the first colonial nation in Africa to become independent with a black leadership constitution modeled in the United States. And Richard Nixon was vice president, and Eisenhower sent him to represent the United States. So she went there to cover that. And in a marvelous moment, Richard Nixon, for the first time, meets Martin Luther King, who's also there. King says to Nixon, you know, you don't have to go to Africa to see the freedom struggle. Why don't you come down south and see what we're doing? Of course, you know, that would be really politically dangerous. So Nixon cleverly says, well, I can't. I'm really busy. But why don't you come to Washington and have a meeting with me? And King does that, and then gets a meeting with Eisenhower. So Nixon is the way that King finally meets the leadership of the United States. So a year after that trip, and back then reporters didn't travel the world like we did. It was, you know, the planes actually broke down. There's no Air Force One that's a 747 and all that. So they decided to hold a reunion at her apartment. And Simeon Booker, who was working for Jet, who'd been on the trip, said to Payne, well, why don't you invite the vice president? And they all had a great laugh, like, heck, you know, he's going to come. So she sends an invitation, and the White House says, yes, you'll show up. So he shows up at her house and doesn't just make a, you know, greet and leave. He stays for the whole evening and has a great time. And just to give you, I wish I could quote it exactly, but to give you the tenor of the time, Jet Magazine runs a photograph, and it says, in a first time, a vice president visits the home of a Negro in Washington. I mean, you know, if you want to take people back to that time, just read that kind of copy. And she admired him for a few years. But she also, you know, she never let her loyalties get in the way. She realized as Nixon changed and as the world changed, she was incredibly critical of him when he came to the White House in 68. When she became iconic and started being called the First Lady of the Black Press, or when she was on CBS, she became a role model for younger people. She was an incredible mentor, particularly for women. I met so many women for whom Ethel Payne had opened up the door, gotten a job, and then, of course, they told me the first thing that happened if they got the job is she'd show up and say to them, now you be quality, reminding them that I didn't get you this job just for anybody. But that's sort of a role that's duplicated in lots of areas when people are firsts of anything or break down a barrier. I think her writing really ended up being the most important because you say it's a small audience, but she was the eyes on the movement for people who weren't in the movement. And Chicago and Detroit and Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Courier, carrier copy. These are the places where people like Martin Luther King came to get funding. They, you know, he'd fly north regularly for fundraisers. These were the people who were going to support what was going on in the South. And she was their trusted eyes. And we forget that there was an enormous difference between the way mainstream media, which is what we call it today, but let's be frank, white-controlled media in the 50s was reporting the news, and the black media. And one of the things I was struck by when I read her coverage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, and the act passes, the New York Times and other papers treat it as if it's a munificent gift being given by white folks to black folks. But if you read her copy, it's the rights that we've been denied, we are now winning. Very different kind of verbs. And I think the movie Selma represents that same kind of thing. It's not something that's being given, it's something from a struggle that we are getting that we already owned. And that's why I think it's so important to go back and read these papers, because it still shapes attitudes today. I think the polling data that we get across ethnic groups, across gender, these things aren't just casual. They come from deep roots. And I think the segregation of the press in the 1950s and 60s is something people fail to understand its significance to this day. And Ethel Payne played a key role for a large part of the population in informing them and, secondly, activating them.
You're listening to Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. I'm Askia Muhammad.
Any disappointments in your career?
Oh, many, many disappointments. Many disappointments. I'm disappointed that we haven't achieved the gains, or that we haven't held on to the gains that we made so painfully in the 60s. And that's because I think some of us went to sleep. And the attack on affirmative action really worries me. So that's a direct assault on what we got with blood, sweat, and tears. And I think we just have to, it's Armageddon time. And we have to sort of go down our armor and just be prepared to fight.
What do you consider your greatest personal victory?
Well, I think in some way that I deserve some credit for having impacted on some of the gains in civil rights because of my advocacy style of reporting. I think that period in the White House when I was challenging the president and asking him provocative questions, even though it angered President Eisenhower, but it did bring things out into the open. And I can say without equivocation that because of my aggressive style, the white press, which had been ignoring some of these things, suddenly began to sit up and take notice. And instead of putting the civil rights things on the back burner as they had been doing, suddenly they began now really going after these stories. They didn't always interpret it right or do it right, but it became front page interest. And that's really the role of the black press. It's the role of black journalism, even those who are in the white-dominated press. They have a charge. They have a charge. We have just got to just keep the thing right out in front, keep needling. I tried to cover the White House as best as I could, but that was a one-person operation. I not only had the White House cover, I had to watch the civil rights battle on Capitol Hill. Clarence Mitchell, bless his heart. And I owe him a debt of gratitude because he was Seth's most helpful. And I admire him deeply because he so honestly deserves that title of 101st Senator. If it had not been for Clarence Mitchell, we would be in sad condition today.
You're listening to Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. I'm Askia Muhammad.
She, in many ways, even though she voted in Chicago, like many Chicagoans, she really ceased to be a Chicagoan when she came to Washington. And when in 1958 she separates from the Defender for 9 years, she doesn't go back to Chicago. She had the same problems, even from a distance. She fought over the tiniest bits of money. They hardly paid her. For a while, she worked as a freelancer secretly in order to supplement her income. And it was a struggle. But it was for her the perfect venue. And it's you know, you mentioned having been a freelancer, and I have been a freelancer. There are times when we end up writing for people, not for the money. We need the money to pay the rent, but it's for another reason. And I think she saw it that way. She loved the paper. She was so loyal to it. And of course, she grew up in its back door. I mean, when she was growing up in Bronzeville, as part of Southside would have been nicknamed, you know, there were institutions. There was the St. John's AME Church that her mother taught Sunday school and that bound her family. But, you know, there was cosmetic companies, there was banks, there were jazz halls, and the Defender. And these were important parts of her sense of identity. It isn't like she got to work for the Los Angeles Times. She was working for the paper that she, as a child on Friday, was the most significant thing. And I think in many ways, Sendstack and others took advantage of that. I mean, they constantly said, we're a cause, you know. I mean, you know, using that in many ways to take advantage. Her real hero in many ways was Louis Martin. I mean, he trained her. There's a section of the book where he gets furious with her over her reporting, and I had the letters, and you just couldn't believe it. It was like brother-sister argument, you know, how dare you do this? But he loved her. And he stood up for her. And when in 1967 she'd been away for the paper, it was he who called up and said, you know, we want you back, and sent her off to Vietnam. In 67 she's called back to work for the paper, and they send her to cover Vietnam, which is both a good and a sad story. What she was unaware of is that the White House was manipulating things at this moment. 1967 is a pivotal year in terms of American support of the war, and the African-American community had been surprisingly supportive of the war. And I shouldn't say surprisingly, but the military offered young American blacks a chance at a much more meritocracy. I mean, Colin Powell would be the classic example. And Vietnam is the first desegregated war in which whites were taking orders from blacks. And I don't want to say I'm portraying it too favorably. Trust me, there's a lot of awful things going on. But to the African-American community, Vietnam was not the horror it had been to the white. And they wanted to shore up support. So they were suggesting that sending a reporter be a good thing. And, of course, a reporter going to the war zone is paid for by the government, all the transportation. So coincidentally, she gets a call from Chicago Defender saying, would you like to come back and work for us? And we're going to send you to Vietnam. The headline is, Chicago Defender to have its own man in Vietnam. And then the second headline, it's a girl! Exclamation mark. But she's in charge of writing about the fate of black troops. She's not sent there to write about the war. And she writes really interesting articles about troops where African Americans are in leadership positions. She does write some articles about some very racist and difficult moments, but she focuses solely on that. And she regrets many years later having, in a sense, missed the bigger story of Vietnam. But after that, she works in D.C., but they do call her back to Chicago. They ask her to come back and be an editor, and it's a very unsuccessful moment. She's been away from Chicago for too long. She's a Washingtonian. She's not interested in Chicago politics. In fact, I joke that her favorite seat at that moment was on an airplane. She was traveling the world. She went off to cover Kissinger's visits to Africa and all these things. And so for Sendstack, he wrote her a note saying, look, we're paying you all this money and you're never here. And they finally part ways. They have a reunion a few years later, and it's very sweet. It's sort of like it's a little bit like a parent and child who've had problems, who are now older, and say, why do we fuss about these things? And they both, they meet in Baltimore, I think it's Baltimore, and they big hugs and a lot of conversation. So in the end, her final divorce from the Defender ended up being friendly. But, you know, she had no pension. She was living off Social Security. She ended up self-syndicating her articles, which is humiliating in many respects because most of the papers she self-syndicated with weren't paying her. She'd then have to send a dunning notice. And the other thing that happened to her is both a veneration, which isn't necessarily great when you're older. People began to see her as the famous Ethel Payne, and she still wanted to be in the action. And so she knows she was getting calls from places. But the best two things she ended up doing was teaching at Jackson State and Fisk and being Professor Payne. Keep in mind, she didn't have a college degree. Meant an awful lot for her. And then I mentioned, you know, the South African campaign against apartheid. She went to meet Nelson Mandela shortly after he got out of prison. And there's a photograph of her in the book with him. And I love her sense of humor. I mean, she's meeting the most significant man in the world. And by the photograph, she scribbles something about, well, lots of people got to interview Nelson Mandela, but I'm the only one who did so when he was in his pajamas. You know, I miss not having had a chance to meet her. In 1981, I was a reporter, and the hostages were freed. And everybody who had a press pass was on the White House South Lawn to see them being welcomed back. And I was there. And I'm dying to go back and look at pictures with a magnifying glass and see if maybe I was 30 feet away from her. When Ethel Payne was 40 and ends up coming to the Chicago Defender, it's Louis Martin who recognizes her journalistic ability. I love that because my father used to refer to me as a late bloomer. And Ethel Payne, not by any fault of her own, she'd been denied everything, but she becomes a successful journalist in her 40s, not in her 30s. And he mentored her in a way that no one else did. When she came to Washington, there were several women here who taught her some aspects of Washington Way, but he was the one who saw her raw talent as a journalist, who, when she spent her first few years in Chicago, guided her as to what kinds of stories. And he was always there when she needed something. When she needs a political job, he's the one who looks out for her. And when it's time to come back to the Defender, he's the one who brings her back. And, you know, I wrote a biography of Ethel Payne, so I don't know this, but I'm willing to bet, based on the character of what I learned about Martin, that he did this for a lot of people. And I understand, I think you're really right about the rivalry. It's a bit, to use the Washington Post example, it might be a little bit like Kay Graham when Ben Bradley becomes famous. It's not always comfortable when you own the place and the people who run it are the ones who are being called up. I'm sure Martin was aware, because there are many moments in his life when people pay tribute to him, and the number who lined up, who thought, you know, what he'd done for them. And Ethel was just devoted to him for that reason.
She never married?
No, she never did. She had a fiancé in 1948 whom she only identifies as Paul. She never gives his last name, and she leaves him behind when she goes to Japan, and after a year, he's not willing to wait. But she also ran into a problem, and I say this from my own research, particularly interviewing women, that a professional and an aggressive professional woman in the 1950s was very off-putting to men. And basically the choice that she would have been given if a man said, I'd like you to marry me, it would be, I'd like you to marry me and give up what you're doing. And she was never going to do that. And for a while I was saddened, because I've been married for 33 years and it's an important part of my life, and I thought she was denied that. But in the course of my research, I began to meet so many women who surrounded her at the end of her life. They all refer to themselves as her niece and her aunt, that I realized she never had her own children, but in a sense she had a huge cadre of children and people who stayed around her.
You're listening to Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. I'm Askia Muhammad. Ethel Payne was the first recipient of the Ida B. Wells Distinguished Chair of Journalism at Fisk University, where she set about the task of helping train a new generation of dedicated black journalists in the techniques and tactics that move black people's news from the obituary pages to the front pages.
What advice would you give to a young, particularly black journalist, but a young journalist?
A young journalist, first thing you have to do is to have creativity and to really look for the story behind the story, and to be aggressive about projecting that story. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just believe that black journalists have a responsibility to be advocates, you know, because we're black, first of all, before we're journalists. And there's so much out there that isn't reported adequately or so much that's distorted, that I just believe that we have a responsibility to dig and bring out the true nature. Because as long as we have this institutionalized racism in this country, and racism in all its virulent forms, somebody has to speak out, and who better should do that than the people in the media, because we are the pipelines.
Who is the most influential / inspirational person in your life / career?
It's not one person. I guess it's a composite.
Who comes to mind?
My mother, first of all.
My mother was a widow. She was widowed when I was quite young. And we had a very difficult time. But she had a great, great deal of fortitude. And she had such strength about her that she was able to just keep us going even through the hardest times. And she constantly inspired me. Although I had to get my education piecemeal because there just wasn't the money to send me away to college or anything. But she just kept saying, you've got it in you and you can do it. And you can do it and you can't let anything get in your way. And of course she was a deeply religious woman. And so I would say she really had a very strong impact on me.
Did you ever imagine that your career would take you to all the places that you've been to see?
Never in my wildest moments, but it started out when I went overseas to become an Army Special Services Director in Japan. And from then on, I think I've been traveling most of my life. Because it was shortly after that I came back here and I joined the Chicago Defender staff. And I started out as a feature writer. And then it was Louis Martin who assigned me to go south. I had never been south in my life. And I started out going south to cover some of the events. And this was before Montgomery. And I wrote a long series of articles about my impressions. And I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the owner of the Oklahoma Eagle, Ed Goodwin, met me, and he decided he just had to have me for his paper. So he made all kinds of offers to me. Fabulous salary in those days, $300 a month. And he even got his attorney friend to come over and drop some paper that would give me share in the paper. And when I got back to Chicago, I showed all this to Louis Martin. He grunted and he said, hell, if you haven't got 51%, forget it. He said, if you're so restless, why don't you go on down to Washington? Now, we need somebody down there. You go on down there and stay 6 months. If you don't like it, come on back home. So that's how I got here.
Mm-hmm. All this traveling and families of your own don't mix. Did you ever consider a family life of your own?
I was engaged twice.
What happened, cold feet?
No. Both times I went off on some other adventure. I left the guy standing. So, well, maybe it wasn't to be.
Life is a shadow and a mist. It passes quickly by and is no more.
She led a charmed life.
Yeah, she liked to think of herself as having a box seat on history, and she thought she was privileged for having that. Charmed in the sense that I may be misattributing who said it, but I think it was Frederick Douglass who said that luck is the combination of opportunity and preparedness. Many of us are given opportunities in life, but you're not prepared. Ethel Payne was really prepared for her job. She didn't know it, but her struggles to write, her interest in being an attorney, her particular background in Southside Chicago was so different than other Southsiders. She had no idea how it was going to serve her, but they all came to serve her. So I think the charm is that when the moments came, she was ready for them, and she served them wonderfully.
Ethel Payne's disarming humor was apparent when she spoke publicly, here at a Washington testimonial for her in 1980.
Induced by your praises, I think I must borrow some words from Jack Valenti and paraphrase a little. If I had known that you were going to say so many pretty things about me, I should have done a decent thing and died first. I feel like Tom Sawyer. Holly thought he had been drowned in the Mississippi River, and his body couldn't be located. So she went ahead with the funeral service in absentia of the corpse. Well, Tom, who had hid out to keep from being punished, crept into the church balcony to listen to the services. And he enjoyed it so much until he sneezed and gave himself away. Whereupon Ann Polly, the chief mourner, administered a sound thrashing. For me, this is indeed a family reunion, for you are all my extended family. I owe appreciation to so many for this tribute. It would be impossible for me to adequately thank you. Tonight you have heaped honors upon me. And like Tom, I have thoroughly enjoyed the eulogies. In fact, when the time comes to check out from this life, there will be nothing left to say unless Simeon Booker can think of a new animal.
She's Ethel L. Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press.
This program was written, narrated, and produced by Askia Muhammad, who is solely responsible for its content.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres with support from the Pacifica Radio Archives staff. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part from Pacifica Station listeners like you. Current preservation projects are funded in part by grants from the Grammy Foundation and the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more, please visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for listening and keeping our